episode of GeoTalk, we head down to the University of Melbourne to see how they're improving turn-by-turn navigation. We travel down the south coast of New South Wales to do a bit of geocaching. And we announce the winners of the Keeper of Time competition. All this and a lot more on GeoTalk. Well, welcome to episode 52 of GeoTalk. I'm your host, Darren, also known as Spin Doc Bob from the Spin Doctors. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. If you're a returning listener, thanks very much for supporting the podcast. Don't forget, the website for the podcast is www.geotalkpodcast.com. And also, there's a YouTube channel. We haven't put a video up for a while, but I have a feeling there's one going to go up in the next few weeks. That's at youtube.com/GeoTalk. Well, a few items to get through before we head down to the Uni of Melbourne. First of all, a few episodes back, we talked to Apposphere about the GeoMate Junior GPS. It's a sort of kid-proof, very starter GPS unit for getting into geocaching. They mentioned in that episode that an update kit will be coming out, and the good news is that it is now available. So for Australian users, that means that now you can buy it along with the update kit, and you can upload all the Australian and New Zealand geocaches. Now, my understanding is it will load up all the caches in the region up to a 4-4 terrain and difficulty rating, but it won't load any premium geocaches. So you're still going to get quite a few thousand geocaches out of that. Check out their website at geomatejr.com, or you can click on the link in the show notes of the GeoTalk website. Now, it's springtime, and that means that the magpies are back and they're swooping. In fact, on the way to the railway station on Tuesday morning, I was swooped by a magpie. It's quite a frightening experience because you never hear them coming. You only hear them leaving after they've brushed past your head. So take care. A number of people in the Canberra section of the Geocaching Australia forums have already mentioned about the magpies there, and I'm sure throughout most of the country there are people getting swooped. So just take care. If you get swooped by a magpie, leave the area and maybe come back a little bit later, and also wear a hat just to protect your head while you're out there. Now, last episode, we talked about the International Year of Astronomy GeoCoin that was being sold by DeVixen. I got mine in the mail the other day. It looks fantastic. It's taking pride of place in my collection. Another one that you might want to get your hands on is the Geocaching New South Wales 2009 GeoCoin. Now, it's only going on sale to members at the moment, but I believe on the 5th of October is when it will be open to the general public. Now, it's in the shape of the state of New South Wales, and on one side is the association's logo, which includes a waratah. And on the reverse side, each year is going to be a different icon of New South Wales. And the first one is the Three Sisters from Katoomba up in the Blue Mountains, so that rock formation up there. You can check that out. Go to the association's website. That's geocachingnsw.asn.au. And at the moment, that page for the GeoCoin is only open to members, but on October the 5th, it will be open to the general public for sale, and the funds being from those sales will go towards the association. Now, on the way to work in the car the other day, I was listening to the local ABC radio station, and they had a very funny thing about fantasy voices. Now, I don't know how many of you have it, and it seems to be more of an affliction for us men, but anytime you say throw up a screwed piece of paper into the bin, some of you might sort of yell out, "He shoots, he scores, 3 point, nothing but net." But I wonder, do you do this sort of thing when you're out geocaching, when you get a first to find, or when you're getting that elusive milestone or finding that tricky hide? Does a little voice in your head congratulate you? If you don't know what I'm talking about, have a listen to this.
Breakfast with Adam Spencer on 702 ABC Sydney.
Oh, we spoke yesterday about the fantasy voice. I gave a rare insight into the male condition, that voice that nibbles in the back of your mind. It says, yes, you've done it. Even when the achievement might not have been that large. If you missed the conversation, yesterday after the show, I did the Ken Ken. I was pretty excited at how quickly I did that Ken Ken. As I put the paper down, on the table. I heard in my mind,
he didn't just break his world record, he absolutely shattered it.
The guy screws up a bit of paper and throws it, and it goes in a bin. Suddenly, the mystery voice kicks in, and you have run out Andrew Flintoff with one stump to aim at from deep point.
Got it!
Holding a bunker shot at him.
Cinderella story. Tiger Woods has got nothing.
In the hole.
Phil holds on by a shot.
Well, as a gardener, even pulling out like an onion weed with all the bulbs attached, I'll get the yes.
No.
Oh, well, you might be in the yard digging or sweeping up and you've got the broom or the spade in your hand, and for a split second there, it suddenly becomes a Fender Stratocaster. And you are immediately Jimi Hendrix.
At the age of 45 and a bit rotund and balding, yeah. Still can't walk down a street without dummying all the telegraph poles. And as he dummies the telegraph poles, I hear him mutter, and he's still got it.
And the great thing about dummying the telegraph pole is...
it's not going anywhere.
It's not going anywhere. And the telegraph pole doesn't even know there's a contest on, does it?
No, that's right.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah. But he's still got it.
He's still got it.
And I've got a fantastic one from Bridget. As kids, my brother would practice his rugby league tackles, complete with commentary. Picks her up and dumps her! What strength! What power! That's what Peter hears when he manages to out-muscle his four-year-old in backyard football. You've just had an encounter with a fantasy voice.
Yes, well, he said it out loud as he came and gave me a kiss and a hug goodbye. He stepped left, he stepped right, he's read it like a book.
The voice may be fantasy, but those lampposts that that fat, baldy bloke has done me, they're real, Adam. They're real. And you know that paper that goes in the bin?
Yeah.
That's in that bin, buddy. You've still got it. Men of the world, fantasy voices, stand up.
Well, someone who's still got it's Terry, who emailed me. Adam, I listened with interest to your discussion about the fantasy voice. I'm currently in the preparatory stages of writing my thesis, and often, upon finding an article or a quote that I've been searching for, from the back of my mind, I hear screams of ecstasy and delight as though I've just walked out on a stage at Wembley. I am Freddie Mercury up front of Queen from the late 1980s. We will rock you. As Terry's Google search manages to locate an obscure article that he knew was out there, 26 past.
So that's from ABC 702, Adam Spencer's Breakfast Program. If you've got your own fantasy voice, that one that yells out how well you've done when you've got an FTF find or a milestone or that elusive catch, and why not call it in? Love to hear from you what your fantasy voice is. Or why not dob in a friend if you know someone who actually does it out loud? The phone number is 02-800-5436. And talking about the phone number, we got a call from Wagga. Now it's time to answer the phone. Let's have a listen to who it is.
G'day, Darren. It's Murph from the Riverina here. I've just been listening to Geo Talk on the way out to try and get a first to find. Just thought I'd give you a call and let you know that I'm not too far from a town called Matong, which is about, well, it's not quite halfway from where I live in Leeton to Wagga, where the mega event's going to be next year. I'm hoping that the guys from Wagga haven't had time to come over and pinch this one off me. I've got about 30 metres to go, so I'm going to go keep walking, and I'll give you a call back, let you know how I go. All right, bye.
Well, good luck with that, Murph. I know how competitive they are down in Wagga in the Riverina area of New South Wales. We'll check in with Murph to see how he goes a little bit later on. Two great YouTube videos to check out that I came across. One of them was featured in the GCA forums. It was about an interactive geocaching hunt using YouTube. It's very creative. It's a lot of fun. I'll give you a link in the show notes at geotalkpodcast.com. Check it out and see how you can find this geocache. It's hidden in the garden and see how well you can do it. I'm talking about YouTube videos. There's another one I came across from the Auroral Valley event that was held down in the southern part of the ACT south of Canberra back in November. It's a great video. It goes for a couple of minutes and shows you what it's like geocaching down there in Namajee National Park. So if you've ever thought of caching down there or just wanted to see what it's all about, check out the Auroral Valley event, which is linked from the show notes. Well, it's time now to get into the interview, but before we do, a GeoTalk trivia question for this episode, and this one is for each state and the North and South Islands of New Zealand. Which geocaches had the highest number of finds for each state and for the North and South Island? the answer to that at the end of the podcast. Well, joining us now on Geo Talk is Dr. Matt Duckham. He's from the University of Melbourne to talk to us a bit about an interesting addition to in-car GPS systems and online mapping. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
Now, first of all, tell us a little bit about your role at the University of Melbourne. What are you doing and what area are you researching?
So I'm a senior lecturer in the geomatics department, which is in the School of Engineering. So geomatics is connected with information about space, so capturing and presenting, communicating and processing information about space. And my particular interest is in processing spatial information, computing with it, computing with it in all sorts of different scenarios, for example, where humans have to use it because humans have rather different ways of processing information to computers.
Mm. And obviously you've come from overseas. What brought you to Australia?
Well, Australia's actually one of the world leader in geomatics, and so the department at the University of Melbourne is very well known, so it's an attractive place to come, both for the academic and, of course, a lovely place to live. So,
okay, excellent.
Lots to bring here.
Now, you mentioned a little bit about humans and the way in which they use information data. I mean, we hear lots of stories of people using GPSs and ending up on railway tracks and in the middle of lakes and so forth. I mean, what is it about humans and their use and I suppose mistrust or overtrust of GPS?
Well, I'm not sure it's necessarily a trust issue. It's just that GPS and computing technology, measurement technology, is generally very good at doing exactly that, measuring locations, measuring distances, directions. But that's not how humans structure information about space. We use rather different structures. So one good example is landmarks, and that's regarded as one of the most basic structures that humans form when we gain experience of an environment, and that's rather a different type of information to measurement.
So when you talk about landmarks, can you give us a sort of example? I mean, is that like when I ask someone directions to get from point A to B, and they describe it in sort of, you know, abstract terms, take the second left and the fourth right and head down the end of the street, that sort of thing?
Indeed, yes, a good example. And so there's been work that shows that about 85% of human instructions, routing instructions, involve some reference to landmarks, things like turn left at the post office and continue past the park, all those sorts of things. So that's a structure that we use all the time. And what makes a landmark is it's different, it's kind of unique, distinct from the environment. And normally in at least one of three ways. So it'll either be visually salient, so perhaps a different color, much bigger in some way, it looks different. It might be semantically different. It could be that it has a lot of meaning, like a petrol station or a police station that has particular meaning as opposed to just any old building. And the structural aspects are important. So where the landmark is on the route, if it's on a decision point somewhere where you've got to make a turn, then that's also likely to be more important, likely to be more suited as a landmark.
Okay, so using landmarks, I suppose, is a more human way of giving directions and following directions. But I mean, how is it that we find it difficult to work with technology that says things like at the next, you know, in 200 meters, turn left and take the second exit on the roundabout? Is it that foreign to us that we don't cope?
It is, yes. We're very bad at estimating distances. So and we in many cases systematically bad. So I mentioned that landmarks are the kind of foundation of human knowledge about space. It's the first thing that we when we encounter a new environment, it's the first thing that we form information about. And then there's the next level up is route information, so paths connecting different landmarks. And then there's a third level called survey knowledge, which is where you're able to form a kind of overview and hypothesize about the existence of paths that you've not seen, routes that you've never seen. And these sort of structures are well studied, but nowhere in there does metric information, does measured information come in. We're just very bad at estimating it. And in general, humans don't naturally refer to distance information, precise distance information, unless all sorts of other communication techniques tend to break down. So it really is a last resort for humans.
Right. So it seems to make a lot of sense, because when I go out geocaching, I get told that the cache is another 100 or 400 meters away. I seem to underestimate or overestimate. I never quite get it right, and I'm constantly looking up. So I think what you've said has made a lot of sense, that we can't judge those distances very well.
Yes, most people have a lot of difficulty with that.
Now, that led into some research or some work that you did with Census, and Census is an Australian company that does a lot of mapping and GIS work. Tell us a little bit about what you did for them.
Well, they came to us initially, not just me, but a colleague, Stephen Winter, who's also a lecturer at the University of Melbourne in the geomatics department. And they wanted to be able to add landmarks to their navigation instructions on their Where Is site, but they weren't really sure how to go about it. And so they contacted us, because, in fact, that's an area that Stefan and I have worked in for quite a long time. So there is a solid body of research, some of which addresses some of the ways you can compute with these sorts of information. And there's also some other work on cognitive studies, actually human subject studies on some of these issues, such as how often humans use references to landmarks. So that's why they came to us, and it proved to be very fruitful. It worked, I think, very well from both sides. We had an opportunity to implement a lot of the ideas that we find exciting, and we can get we publish in academic journals, but also I think they got some help with a genuinely practical problem.
Okay, so they've implemented it into one of their products, which is whereis.com, I suppose, for lack of a better term, for those who aren't familiar with it, it's a bit like Google Maps, but it's Census version. And I tried it out, and I encourage everyone to give it a go, because it's quite interesting. It does throw up these landmarks. How many landmarks are there in that map, and does it cover all of Australia?
It does cover all of Australia. I can't remember the exact number of landmarks, but I think it's of the order of about 150,000 at the moment. But it's rapidly increasing as well. So the model that we use is, if you like, information hungry. It's landmark hungry. The more landmarks you throw at it in general, the better it will do, because it's all about selecting landmarks from all the possibilities. Actually, we're quite hopeful that you'll get increasingly good results as they're able to put more points of interest into the database.
So what criteria did you set up to define the landmarks that you started off with?
Well, they follow these the three core criteria that I mentioned before: visual salience, how the landmark looks, the semantics, the meaning we associated with it, and the structure in connection with the route, whereabouts in the route that the landmark is. We have had the difficulty, and the reason why no one's really done this before, is that in general we don't have very good information about the detailed visual detailed visual salience of a building. Increasingly, there are things like Street View that are building 3D models and also getting imagery from streets. But in general, it's quite difficult to get good information about what a landmark looks like. So we had to use, instead of information about what it actually looked like, we used a model of how classes of points of interest looked. So, for example, in general, takeaway establishments are generally bright, well lit. Same with petrol stations, gas stations. They're generally well lit, well understood. People know petrol stations. Conversely, things like churches might be expected to have relatively high visual salience because they're generally architecturally different, often bigger than their surrounding buildings. But at the same time, in terms of semantics, they may be, while they're well known to some people, there may be others to them where churches don't have so much meaning. So balancing all those things led us to essentially a model that's able to select from all the possible landmarks the one that's most likely to be suitable for someone to refer to.
Okay, so obviously there are objects that stand out, and as you mentioned, things that are lit up, so they have to stand out at night as well.
Yes, yeah, that's an interesting point, because with the Where Is site, most of the use of that site is people logging on, getting a route, and even printing that out or writing it down or in some way storing it for later use. So we don't actually know whether they're going to be used at day or night. So that's exactly the sort of thing that the model takes into account, whether whether a landmark is likely to be visible throughout the day or just in the day or just in the night. Mm-hmm. But that leads quite nicely on to some what I hope will be some of the future applications of this, because increasingly people don't just print out their routing instructions, of course. They've got PDAs and in-car navigation systems. And so in those cases, we actually know what time someone is doing these things, so we can further refine the references to landmarks, because we've got a better idea of what it should look like.
So it could be time dependent. If it was nighttime, you could add in landmarks or activate landmarks that were more lit up, such as takeaway stores or buildings that have lighting, and in the daytime it would change to something else, for example.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Okay, fantastic. Okay. So you mentioned future applications would be in-car GPSs. Is there any talk of when that might occur?
I'm not sure, actually. That would be one I would have to ask the team at Where Is, because in Census, the in-car navigation group and the Where Is group are they're in the same building, but they have rather different remits. So I'm not sure if and when it's going to be extended by Census. But in general, it's directly applicable to all those sorts of navigation systems.
And is this the first time in the world that this sort of bit of research has been incorporated into mapping systems?
Yes, we think it is, because there are one or two online systems that do make reference to what we'll call landmarks, but actually do something rather different. They have a previously defined set of landmarks, so someone's just gone through and said, this is a landmark, and so it's always referred to when a route goes near it. Or they're actually really just advertising vehicles, so they only refer to things that where someone's paid to have their establishment referred to. So as far as we're aware, we're the first, this is the first time in the world that we've applied a cognitive model, a human model of spatial cognition to selection of these landmarks. And I think that's a world first as far as we're aware.
Right. And have you had any response from other companies or from other research bodies overseas about this work?
Well, we've been very pleased with the range of different media interest that there's been. So, there's been a range of articles about it, and that's been very nice. I don't think we've had any other companies come to us, but actually the work, we're in the process of publishing a scientific paper on it, on the the actual model that we use and that we developed. So in fact, that's now will very shortly be in the public domain anyway. So hopefully more people will be able to use it.
Well, look, it's some fascinating stuff. I encourage people, everyone who's listening, to get onto whereis.com and try it out. And look, Matt, thanks very much for taking out the time in your schedule to chat to us about it, and all the best in the future.
Thank you very much, Darren. It's lovely to speak to you.
Let's take a look at some of the events that are occurring around the country over the next couple of weeks. Now, in New South Wales, there is the Awadigangs 4x4 event that's being held near Wyong by the Rats. That's on the 26th of September. And in South Australia, in Kadena, is the Sunday Lunch in Kadena. That's being held by Lily Sue and Boxer on the 27th of September. Up in the Flinders Ranges in South Australia is We Didn't Start the Fire by the Parrots, and that's on the 3rd of October. And in Queensland, in Bundaberg, there's two events on consecutive days. On the 3rd of October is Meet the Bundys for Dinner by Sully, and on the 4th of October, the second annual Meet the Bundys Get Together by Team Fudley. If you've got an event that you want to give a shout out or a bit of a promo for, give us a call on the GeoTalk hotline or drop us an email, geotalkpodcast@gmail.com. Well, a few weeks ago, I decided that I wanted to get a few more earthcaches because I'm getting closer and closer to that platinum level, and I want to get there before they run out of platinum pins, and I decided to head down to the south coast where there are two earthcaches down in the little town of Kiama, and also along the way was a Where I Go cache that's located in Wollongong, and I also thought I might just try and find that cache that's named after the GeoTalk podcast over in Thirroul, thanks to Pagelboy. So grabbed the GPS, grabbed the backpack, headed into the Geo Gulf and headed south down the south coast to Wollongong and Kiama. Here's a bit of audio that I captured during that trip.
Well, here we are on the road travelling down to Kiama, and I'm heading down there on a gorgeous Sunday. It's quite out of the ordinary for August, but I've been given the day off from my parental responsibilities to go find some geocaches because the spin doctors have been a bit slow over the last few months. And I decided to use the opportunity to head down to Kiama, just out the Wollongong, to find two earth caches and then hopefully also bag a Where I Go cache, which is in Wollongong. So we're heading out of Sydney now. The GPS has had a bit of a fit to start off. It didn't know how to calculate how to get down there, but it seems to have settled down now. Yeah, and so along the way, we'll tell you how we go looking for the Where I Go cache using Nay's smartphone, and then hopefully we'll find the two earth caches fairly easily as well. So join us on a day of caching down at Kiama. Well, half an hour later, about 36 kilometres north of Wollongong, and because I've decided to mix it up a little bit, I've also loaded in some waymarks into my GPS, and one popped up on the screen, which is from a category that I haven't found before, and that is graffiti art. And yeah, stopped by and found quite an interesting mural there underneath the freeway. A little bit dangerous to pull off. You had to find a spot a little bit further down the road where there was enough room for me to park the car and then get out safely. But anyway, that was interesting. And there was a geocache nearby, which wasn't too difficult to find. It took a little bit of work, but I found it. So we continue on, heading towards the Gong. And I'll talk a little bit later about finding caches along the way to your destination and how it might distract you. Well, I've stopped along the way at Thirroul, which is just north of Wollongong, and it's the home of Pagelboy, and a bit remiss of me, I should have given him a call to say I'm dropping in, but I might plan it for another time fairly soon, because the main objective of this is to get down to Kiama, and I need as much time as I can. Anyway, I decided to stop and try and find the GeoTalk cache, which Pagelboy put out in honour of the podcast. Unfortunately, I can't find it. It's a DNF. But it's a lovely spot. A little bit windy today. There's a bit of a northeasterly blowing. But it's just great. There's lots of surfers out here, and I can see why Pagelboy enjoys living down here then Thoreau just north of Wollongong. Oh well, back into the car, off to Wollongong. Well, I finally arrived now at the starting point for where I go case here in Wollongong. It's a very, very busy day down here at the park. It took me about 15 minutes to even get out of the car park to find somewhere else to put the car. But look, it highlights that I'm an hour later than I planned on being here, so it's already after one. And it shows what happens when you just duck out to find one or two caches. So an important thing when you're looking to achieve a goal on a bit of a drive, just limit the number of caches that you decide to do on the side. Anyway, we'll head over to the Where I Go cache now. Well, the theme for this Where I Go cache is skydiving, because there's a bit of a skydiving centre in amongst the park. I think people sort of go off to a plane somewhere and then parachute down here. It was quite interesting getting to the first point because it's in between a game of cricket, of family cricket, and of volleyball. And I'm standing right between the two and worried I'm going to get hit by a ball. Anyway, I've got to wander off now to a series of points to collect a weather report and some a jumping gear parachute, of course, and a lesson. And then, obviously, then they're going to give me the location of the cache. Here we go, off the next point. Well, we completed the series of tasks. We had to move to a couple of different points, and then at one of them you had to collect some infantry, you know, like goggles and parachute and so forth, which we did. I had to go to the final briefing. I went back to one of the wrong locations, but eventually found that. And then last but not least, got to the last waypoint, which gave me the coordinates. And I'm around about 50 metres away from those. So I've got to head off now amongst the maddening throngs to find the final, hopefully find the cache for this Where I Go cache down in Wollongong. Well, cache successfully found, although it was a little bit of work. It was actually jammed in its hiding spot, and it was a micro, and it took quite a bit of work. I almost lost a pen in the process trying to extract it. And then, as I was filling out the log, car parked right next to me, only about 3 feet away. It's just parking at a premium around here. Anyway, the cache has been put back. I think there's so much muggle activity going on at the moment that no one really noticed what I was up to. So there we go, the Where I Go successfully done. So that's one out of the four tasks completed, one failed, one completed, two more to go, and time to head south to Kiama. Well, here I am just south of Kiama. I'm at the Kiama small blow hole. There it goes again. This has to be one of the most fun caches, if not the most fun I've ever had earth caching, because there's a little blowhole just here on the coast. And the wind is blowing from the northeast, which is just perfect for it. And there's these huge eruptions of seawater that are bursting up through the hole. And you can check out a couple of photos attached to my log. I'll give you a link in the show notes. But this is fantastic. If you're a bit cynical about earth caching, you must try this one, the little blowhole down south of Kiama. Well, that's three tasks completed. Off to the fourth one. Well, it's 5:30 and I'm on the road back to Sydney, still a little bit south of Wollongong, and a few things went wrong. Basically, I'm an hour and a half, almost 2 hours behind schedule. The main fault was at the last earth cache, I didn't look properly at the map, and I started off from the wrong spot, got to within a few metres of GZ, and then realised I was up the top of a cliff, and there was no way I was going to be able to get down. So there's a lesson, read the map. The next thing then I had problems with is I decided to have a quick look for another cache, which wasn't a good move. Okay, I'd only spent about 5 minutes looking for it, but I think that, once again, as I said earlier, that the things you've got to be careful of. That is, when you have a goal in mind, you really need to stick to it as tightly as you can. Now, I think I did a pretty good job. I mean, looking at the GPS, there were more than 100 caches I've gone past, some of them simple drive-bys. It's an important point. You've got to remain focused on your task because you can really blow out your time. And while it's easy to say, well, it only takes me 5 minutes to find this cache, if it does take you 15, it takes you 5 to get in, 5 to get out, well, there's nearly half an hour straight away.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that trip down the south coast. The unfortunate thing was Not only did I not find the Geotalk Acache, but it seems as though many others have found it since, including one on the very day that I was there. So looks like another trip's going to have to be had. I might have to catch up with Pagel Boy and get him to give me a few hints on how to find caches up in the Thurl area north of Wollongong. Well, it's time now to get into the Geo Talk mailbag. And first of all, I've got an email from Griffo. He wants to know, where do I get all these stats and figures for the Geo Talk trivia contest? Well, it's no secret. It's fairly easy. One of them, I go to the geocaching website, geocaching.com website, and just set up various pocket queries. So do things like show me how a list of all the webcams that are in Australia, or give me a list of all the five geocaches there. Another good website I use is Caught at Work's website. Now, Caught at Work is one of the fairies or developers, whatever he wants to be called, of the Geocaching Australia website. And he's got his own personal website with a section on geocaching stats and graphs. And I'll give you a link from the show notes at geotalkpodcast.com. You can click on that and head to the stats and maybe make up your own trivia questions for your next trivia night at your next geocaching event. Well, it's time now to head back down to Wagga and find out how Murph is going in that first to find hunt.
Yeah, Murph here again, just coming up on a likely looking spot. You might have to see where this one's hidden. It's actually called Matty's Treasure Chest. And looks like... Aha! Ooh, good size too. Nicely sized cache. Question is, has anyone been here before? And it's a blank logbook. This means I can stir up Rooster Man and the boys over in Wagga for not beating you to it. Anyway, I look forward to seeing everyone at the Wagga Mega event, and I'll catch you later. Bye.
Well, congratulations, Murph, on gaining that first to find. I know they're a pretty competitive bunch down there in Wagga. And just in case you've forgotten, it's coming up very soon, the Wagga Wagga Mega event, which is going to be happening in Easter next year. Now, I know that's still a few months away, but just a reminder that accommodation is going to be tight if you're not planning on camping, that is, because there are a few other events happening in Wagga over Easter. If you want to find out more about the Mega event, head to RivCache, that's RivCache. .com, or keep in touch through the podcast. We'll give you an update in another couple episodes' time on what's happening with the Wagga Wagga Mega event. Now it's time to announce the winners of our competitions. Now, first of all, we've got to announce the winner of the Keeper of Time comp. Now, unfortunately, we had a bit of a problem with the audio. Keith, Keeper of Time, and myself picked the winners from this contest. And thank you very much to all the entrants. We did a bit of a call out on Facebook and gathered a few more entries, which was excellent work. And I think we might use that a little bit more in the future, use the GeoTalk Facebook group. But out of those, Keith and myself picked out three, and Keith sent through a few notes. So the winners for the A Keeper of Time competition, and we're going to read these out in the next episode along with a couple of others. One of the prizes is going to go to Garden Gorilla, and as Keith says, it's great to see someone else who thinks that the best time to geocache is any time, but especially in the other nine circumstances that were listed, it's just what geocaching is all about. Another one goes to Julia from Jasajara, and for similar reasons as above, but we love the way that you described geocaching using the mnemonics. That was really good. Love the presentation, so thank you very much for that, Julia. And another one to Agent Basil, goes by the name of Kim, I think, in real life. What determination. So much effort and so much time, but still no smiley for that cache. So congratulations to you three. That's Garden Group. Gorilla, Julie from Jura, I think it is, or Jusajuru, and Kim from Agent Basil. Drop us an email in the next 2 weeks with your name and address, and we'll post out those. And also let us know in order of preference which one of those timepieces you would like. And if you've forgotten, head back to the show notes, episode 50 of on the Geo Talk podcast website. Also, a special mention to Nils from TNLNSL. It was great to, he said, great to get an overseas entry. And sorry you just missed out on the prize, but thank you very much for entering the competition. And as we do every couple of episodes, every two episodes, in fact, we give away a prize from geocachestore.com.au, who are proud supporters of the podcast. And thank you very much to Zoe and Aaron, who look after the store. And if you want to check out anything, you need to get anything at all for geocaching, check out their store at geocachestore.com.au. They're even selling GPS units, and some of them heavily reduced. So if you're looking at upgrading a unit, go to their store and check it out. Now, the winner for this particular episode, who's going to pick up a Bison Tube and a glow-in-the-dark geocoin, and the winner is Griffo. Thanks very much, Griffo, for your email this episode, and thank you everyone who contributed to the last two episodes. And we're going to start it again with episodes 53 and 54, so if you want to go into the draw to win a prize from the geocachestore.com.au, just drop us an email with a question or a thought or a comment, or ring in with a milestone, a first to find, anything like that, on 02 800 5436, or send it in via email at geotalkpodcast@gmail.com. Well, it's just about time now to wrap up this another episode of GeoTalk. But before we do, we better give you the answers to the GeoTalk trivia question. Now, the question was, who are the top finders in each of the states and territories of Australia and the North and South Island of New Zealand? And in no particular order, in the ACT, it's Mountain Biker Oz with 3,146. In New South Wales, it's the Rats with 3,035. In Northern Territory, it's NT Storm with 673. In Queensland, IF with 5,397. In South Australia, Liz and Bruce with 5,993. In Tasmania, Team Swampy with 1,971. In Victoria is Macamob with 7,789. In WA is Everlasting with 6,023. In the North Island of New Zealand, ADV with 4,995. And finally, rounding it out is on the South Island, Moneydork with 5,207. Well, that's all for this episode of GeoTalk. In our next episode, we're going to have Yumcha with SA Parrothead, and we're going to learn about how to enter coordinates into our Garmin unit old school. Until next time, safe geocaching.